This is DreamWords. Tom Corvin by Paul Storey.
Chapter 31. Getting Tom to leave the cavern was difficult. But when Catriona agreed to help him take a handful of books back to the cottage, he reluctantly agreed. It's not that he wanted to stay. He hated the place as much as and more than Catriona. But things were happening. No matter how much it hurt, he had to continue forward. And this place, these things, the books, they were clues. He needed to study them all. The night air cleansed his lungs like iced water flushing phlegm. He could taste the sweet night, feel its cold sting in his chest. Pushing down on the metal stirrup, Tom sealed the entrance. It closed as quietly as it opened. Returning to the cottage, Catriona checked on her father while Tom piled her catch on the coffee table and spread the journal beside it. He looked at the title again and thought of the woman sitting on the beach. He could not shake the feeling that she was his mother, but he wondered then about the boy. Until now, he'd given in to the impossible notion that the Tom in his visions and the boy buried in his head were one and the same person. But now, away from the emotional maelstrom surrounding the ruin and the cave, he allowed other, less fanciful possibilities to wander his thoughts. Perhaps Catriona was right. Perhaps he was sensitive to a tragedy imprinted in the fabric of this enigmatic place. Perhaps, too, the powerful senses of love and hate were illusions brought on by his need to belong. And then there was the possibility that there was indeed a connection between him and the long-dead family. A connection as simple as genetic ancestry or as spiritual as reincarnation. Could the memories he experienced be somehow passed from generation to generation? As he pondered this question, Catriona called to him from the other room.
Tom, quick!
When he saw Callum, Tom understood the panic in her voice. The man was soaking wet, swaying his head from side to side as if he was having a slow-motion fit. The cover was pulled aside and the lamp close to his leg.
My God!
Tom said and then regretted it immediately when he saw the concern in Catriona's face. His injured limb was not discoloured. It was dipped in black ink, dabbed by splashes of pussy green.
He's been like this since you left. I don't care what happens anymore. We've got to get help.
Tom fought back the words, about time too, and said instead, I'll go now.
No, if that's gangrene, he could die. And if you get lost, he doesn't get the help he needs.
Tom thought of the map of the cavern in his head. Could he find his way from Cregan to Lochranza? But Catriona was right. Light would dawn in around 3 hours. He should sleep and go then. Catriona recovered her father and wrung a cool cloth into a basin at the side of the bed. She placed it across his forehead and sat down holding his hand, ignoring Tom completely. Tom placed a hand on her shoulder. If you need me, shout. The girl nodded tearfully, her eyes fixed forward as though in a trance. Tom left and retook his position on the settee. Once he spied the journal, sleep and Callum's injury were forgotten, and he settled down for a long read. Kathleen Henderson, all those years ago, moved to Arran to look after George Silas's children. He was a strange man, She could not tell at first if his dismissive manner and reclusiveness were due to his injuries. He was in constant pain, and the carer in her tried to comfort him with small kindnesses. At first he brushed these aside, commanding her not to fuss. But soon Kathleen's attempt to engage with the man brought harsh words and a flash of temper that scared her enough to quell her natural sympathies. She retreated to the care of the children and found in them a happiness she thought belonged to others and not to her. To her horror, the children were not even named. Silas referred to them as him and her until the woman christened them Thomas and Tessa. In the early years, the bizarre man left them for months at a time, bringing with him on each return a compilation of equipment that Kathleen could not understand. She began to fear that the demented creature was undertaking Satan's work. This expression, especially the word Satan, caused Tom to stop reading suddenly. He was terrified by the notion, and for some reason thought of the children he glimpsed in the dark castle, praying to someone or something hidden from his mind. He was certain that Kathleen's comment was no more than a euphemism for work that she suspected as evil. But this did not stop Tom shaking or sweat beading his forehead as the word Satan exploded in his mind, and a billion souls writhed in unknown graves and screamed for the wish to die. And to Tom, it seemed as if the very prayer they screamed flew at him, and for a mad fleeting instant the tortured souls were turned his way and yelled as one,
"Help us! Help us die! Please help us die!"
Chapter 32. If Tom had been left alone with the cry of humanity in his head, he might have gone mad. In fact, he thought he may have already done so. He almost vomited when it happened, and it took all his strength not to scream for help of his own. But who would help him? Katriana and her father had their problems too. No, Tom had to face his demons alone. He had been so focused on trying to find out who he was and how he was connected to Cregan's past that the boy stumbled from one discovery to another with little control over what happened and when. The vision on the boat and his first sighting of Kathleen happened with no obvious input from him. But the seance, his search for the hidden ramp, the pendant, the strange and realistic map of the cavern in his head, all of these were linked to actions he'd initiated. Even the horrific screams had been triggered, it seems, by the journal he'd been reading. He may be mad, but the cave and the chairs and the pendant were real. The journal and the books, puzzle pieces clicking clean and crisp with each new insight. He refused to run. The problem was part of him, and running would surely be for life. He would grasp the challenge tight to his chest and charge. He closed his eyes and recalled the faces and their cries for help. There was nothing special about the people he'd seen. Men, women and children of every age and race howled in anguish, all of them looking his way. All of them, billions it seems, somehow able to occupy the tiny space in his head and yet still maintain an impression of individuality. It had all happened so fast that Tom could not fathom this contradiction, a conglomerate of lonely souls. He could remember no more than four glimpsed faces now. A girl, roughly 14 years old, her hair dyed yellow, her bright white top incongruously set against the twisted skin of her face, her expression distorting otherwise model good looks. A man, white-haired but fit in body, now withered and bent, his head turned towards Tom from a kneeling position, pleading for death. A young boy, about 5, his face aged by pain, tears and snot surrounding the large cavern of his mouth as he bawled in agony. And finally, a black woman, young, brilliant white teeth made for smiling, now gritted between stretched and parched lips as her eyes flared red with agony, and she too joined the chorus pleading for Tom's help, for Tom to help them to die. He paraded them, one after the other, before his inner eye. Doing so, he felt their desperation. He tried to see beyond, to their surroundings, but could not. In his mind, they were a populace of individuals, but there were so many of them that no place on earth could hold them in anything but large groups. Could this be no more than a hellish nightmare, a place where sense and nonsense slept like mismatched lovers? Tom possessed a strange ability to channel things, abnormal things, through his mind. This he accepted. That did not mean, though, that he did not experience normal things. He ate, breathed, walked and talked like everyone else. Why not nightmares? The thought was vaguely comforting. He was saved from his own courage by another scream, this time from the patient and his daughter next door. Tom jumped to his feet and bolted to their aid. Running into the room, he found Katriana wrapping her arms around her father's shoulders, fighting to keep her grip as he thrashed from side to side. As Tom took in the scene, the man suddenly sat up and his legs swung over the side of the bed. The boy instinctively dived for them, wincing at the thought of the giant's bulk bearing down on the bloated and black limb. Callum's eyes were bloodshot, staring wherever his head pointed. Despite the man's strength, Tom managed to pin his feet to the bed as Katriana shushed him as though he were a massive, teething baby. By the time his seizure ended, Tom was in no doubt what had to be done, and for once, he and the girl agreed. Leaving her father's side for no more than 2 minutes, Katriana reminded Tom to follow the path without deviating. It was still dark, but dawn was on its way. She tipped out a small sack, stuffed the torch in his hand, her own waterproof jacket inside the sack, and opened the door as if he had been an unwelcome guest at an overlong party.
"It's only around 5 miles. The weather looks good. Even with the hill, you should be there in 2, maybe 3 hours.
She glanced behind her, anxious to get back to her father. Tom half smiled and turned to go, the light sack slung casually over his left shoulder. Katriana swung the door closed and then paused. They had been moving so fast since the decision was made that this 2-second interlude seemed like the still calm of a painted dream. In that beat, their eyes met, their half-formed smiles locked, and then finally, and slowly, the door closed between them. Tom stood looking at the darkened green wood, blinked away the feelings of dread and loss, turned on his heels, and sprinted towards the path. A faint and light blue wash tinged the ruffled hills across the sea. With the light of the cottage gone, Tom could see enough to move steadily along the path without the torch. Once moving, the surge of adrenaline flooding his system gave him a rush of energy that pushed back the utter exhaustion that should have closed him down. The half-slung sack, now squarely in its proper place over both shoulders, he pummeled hard with one leg and then another, storming up the initial steep climb as though pursued by relentless hunters. Slowing briefly to look at the ruin passing to his left and the rocks hiding the cave, he renewed his climb with perfect rhythm. Sweat on his back, he drove the path as it swung right and levelled out, cutting at an angle along the hill. Below and to his right, the far undulating horizon turned a light pink, and a gentle breeze blew over the water and up the slope. It cooled his face as he watched the land slip slowly beneath him. First the cottage, and then the enormous boulders with their miniature caves and hidden graves. And then the sloping greenery disappeared over what he assumed was the birthing cliff for his present life. In another time, he would have scouted the area to look for a clue of how he got there, but that seemed unimportant now. It was almost light by the time the path rounded over the dip between the hill he was on and the next. The pink line had now stained the underside of high clouds, and the sky became a beautiful roof of spectacular red light. Curving over the saddle, the path started its slow descent into the glen. To his left, and still in shadow, a grey tarmac road roped along the bottom of the hill opposite. A bright yellow car pushed its headlights and its driver towards an unknown day. Running beside a stream, the path disappeared to mud, and then the mud disappeared to path. He slithered and stumbled and ran, and as the scorched sky blued and brightened, he saw a tiny gathering of houses and then another. He saw the road again, back from an excursion hidden by trees, bright grey now, zooming through the green fields as the glen widened towards the sea. He was in another world, a world of people, of transport, of comfort and help. Stopping for nothing, he pumped his arms and continued down the hill and entered the village of Lochranza.
DreamWorks.com.